content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. Since we've used up the material in the January-February combined edition of Smithsonian, I've come up with some other stories from Smithsonian.com. And as I'm reading, realize that this story was written prior to 2019. For the first time in more than 20 years, copyrighted works will enter the public domain. A beloved Robert Frost poem is among the many creations that are finally losing their protections in 2019. By Glenn Fleischman. Whose woods these are, I think I. Whoa, we can't quote any more of Robert Frost's Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening because it is still under copyright as this magazine goes to press. But come January 1st, 2019, we, you, and everyone in America will be able to quote it at length on any platform. At midnight on New Year's Eve, all works first published in the United States in 1923 will enter the public domain. It has been 21 years since the last mass expiration of copyright in the U.S. The deluge of works include not just Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, which appeared first in the New Republic in 1923, but hundreds of thousands of books, musical compositions, paintings, poems, photographs, and films. After January 1st, any record label can issue a dubstep version of the 1923 hits. Yes, we have no bananas. Any middle school can produce Theodore Pratt's stage adaptation of The Picture of Dorian Gray, and any historian can publish Winston Churchill's The World Crisis with her own extensive annotations. Any artist can create and sell a feminist response to Marcel Duchamp's seminal Dadaist piece, The Large Glass, The Bride Stripped Bare by Her Bachelors Even. And any filmmaker can remake Cecil B. DeMille's original, The Ten Commandments, and post it on YouTube. The public domain has been frozen in time for 20 years, and we're reaching the 20-year thaw, says Jennifer Jenkins, director of Duke Law School's Center for the Study of the Public Domain. The release is unprecedented, and its impact on culture and creativity could be huge. We have never seen such a mass entry into the public domain in the digital age. The last one, in 1998, when 1922 slipped its copyright bond, predated Google. We have shortchanged a generation, said Brewster Kahle, founder of the Internet Archive. The 20th century is largely missing from the Internet. For academics fearful of quoting from copyrighted texts, teachers who may be violating the law with every photocopy, and modern-day artists in search of inspiration, the event is a cause for celebration. For those who dread seeing Frost's immortal ode to winter used in an ad for snow tires, Public Domain Day, as it is sometimes known, will be less joyful. Despite that, even fierce advocates for copyright agree that after 95 years, it is time to release these works. There comes a point when a creative work belongs to history as much as to its author and her heirs, said Mary Rasenberger, executive director of the Authors Guild. We can blame Mickey Mouse for the long wait. In 1998, Disney was one of the loudest in a choir of corporate voices advocating for longer copyright protections. At the time, all works published before January 1, 1978, were entitled to copyright protection for 75 years. All authors' works published on or after that date were under copyright for the lifetime of the creator plus 50 years. Steamboat Willie, featuring Mickey Mouse's first appearance on screen in 1928, was set to enter the public domain in 2004. At the urging of Disney and others, Congress passed the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, named for the late singer, songwriter, and California representative, adding 20 years to the copyright term. Mickey would be protected until 2024, and no copyrighted work would enter the public domain again until 2019, creating a bizarre 20-year hiatus between the release of works from 1922 and those from 1923. This hole in history was accidental, but it occurred at a remarkable moment. The novelist Willa Cather called 1922 the year the world broke in two, the start of a great literary, artistic, and cultural upheaval. In 1922, Ulysses, by James Joyce, and T.S. Eliot's The Waste Land were published, and the Harlem Renaissance blossomed with the arrival of Claude McKay's poetry in Harlem Shadows. For two decades, those works have been in the public domain, enabling artists, critics, and others to burnish that notable year as a high gloss in our historical memory. In comparison, 1923 can feel dull, but that was the year Noel Coward staged his first musical, the hit London Calling, and Gene Toomer came out with his breakthrough novel about African-American life, Kane. Because access to these and other works from the year has been limited, our understanding of the tumultuous 1920s is skewed. That will begin to change January 1st, when digital compendia such as the Internet Archive, Google Books, and Hathi Trust will make tens of thousands of books available, with more to follow. They and others will also add heaps of newspapers, magazines, movies, and other material. Much the same will happen every January 1st until 2073, revealing long-overlooked works from the Harlem Renaissance, the Great Depression, World War II, and beyond. After 2073, works published by authors who died seven decades earlier will expire each year. We're going to open these time capsules on a yearly basis and potentially have the understanding of that year and all the contents change, said Paul St. Amour, a professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania and editor of Modernism and Copyright. We can't predict what uses people are going to make of the work we make available, said Mike Furlow, executive director of Hathi Trust, and that's what makes it so exciting. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. How refreshing it is to quote freely from another iconic Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken, published in his poetry collection Mountain Interval in 1916. Its copyright expired in 1992, and that has made all the difference. The poem has inspired lyrics from Bruce Hornsby, Melissa Etheridge, and George Strait, and its phrases have been used to sell cars, careers, computers, and countless dorm room posters that feature the final lines as an exhortation to individualism that the poet likely never intended. On January 1, Hathi Trust will publish Frost's collection, New Hampshire, including Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, online, and it will finally be available for anyone to adapt. Perhaps no one is more bemused by that prospect than the composer Eric Whitaker. In 1999, believing the poem had already entered the public domain, the last-minute copyright extension prevented that, Whitaker accepted a commission to turn it into a choral piece. After just two performances, Whitaker said, Frost's publisher and the Frost estate shut him down, refusing to license the work. Whitaker eventually produced a different version of the work titled Sleep, with lyrics written for it by the poet Charles Anthony Silvestri. He is now considering releasing the work in its original form. All I wanted to do, Whitaker said, is illuminate the original poem with music. When that year's copyright skedaddles, you'll have instant access to countless titles, including these overlooked gems. The Vanishing American in Ladies' Home Journal by Zane Grey, one of the first literary critiques of the treatment of Native Americans, harsher than the later novel and silent film. A Handbook of Cookery for a Small House by Jesse Conrad, a peek into the life of author Joseph Conrad via Wife's Recipe Collection. Our American Adventure by Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, recounts his popular and controversial lecture tour in support of modern spiritualism. The Chip Woman's Fortune by Willis Richardson, the first drama by an African-American author produced on Broadway, a one-act story of a family in financial straits. Nebraska in The Nation by Willa Cather. She laments the cultural and economic homogenization of her beloved state. The Real Story of a Bootlegger by Anonymous, the purportedly honest account of life as a criminal under the 18th Amendment. Prohibition made me a millionaire. This story had 131 responses online. I'll read a few of them for you. From J.R. Colangelo. The public domain is like a natural resource, a renewable one, if we take care of it right. Artists in all mediums build their works from the grand reserve of what came before them, and, if we allow it, contribute those words to the reserve, replenishing it and keeping it alive. Joyce's Ulysses, mentioned in this article, could not have existed without Homer's Odyssey and the epic tradition it helped form. And with the wealth of song, poems, novels, plays, newspaper articles, speeches, and so forth that the novel quotes, I doubt that it would be publishable in the current copyright regime. It survived obscenity, but not intellectual property. But now instead, and despite the efforts of Joyce's grandson who runs the estate, it has become an important part of literary culture. It has paid its debt to the public domain. Few things infuriate me more than Disney's refusal to do the same thing. How many billions of dollars have they made adapting old stories and fairy tales invented by other people? Snow White, Cinderella, Mulan, The Little Mermaid, The Lion King, Frozen, indeed nearly all of the films that form the bedrock of their reputation are, in some way, derived from the public domain. Yet they have taken every step possible to avoid paying back their debts, and I have no doubt that, if it were possible, none of these stories, some of which have existed for centuries, would be usable by any artist absent their approval. Disney's behavior is a little more than cultural theft and the pillaging of a natural resource akin to clear-cutting a rainforest or spewing industrial waste into a river. They are a consortium of cultural bandits and should never have been allowed to amass as much power as they have. The world needs more James Joyces and fewer Disneys. More people who repay their debts as freely as they take them on, artists who leave the reserve of culture richer and fuller than they first found it to be. And Tony G. Pisa replies, maybe so, but Disney would counter how many people know these classic stories at all from their adaptations. Sad to say, Disney has been allowed a power it probably did not aspire to reshape American myth-making and culture. But once they had it, they fought to protect it. Good luck come 2024. They will fight again to protect Mickey Mouse. F. Turla says, the alteration of the copyright rule to extend the length of time before the release of authored material becomes available to the public is too onerous on the public and historical associations assigned to properly evaluate social establishments and culture for past periods. The time extension is a business lobby idea designed to generate revenue of works that no longer benefit the original creators. Edward Rappaport wrote, I happen to have worked on an economic analysis of the 1998 legislation, and my personal feeling then and now is that it was unconstitutional. The Constitution provides for patent and copyright protections for limited terms, but it appears that Congress intended to make these perpetual. Note that the works of 1923 were originally scheduled to end in 1979, but extended by Congress at the last minute. Eventually, the Supreme Court rejected the case along these lines. Ever since, I've held my breath, waiting to see if big media interests were going to do it again. When the glittering ball falls in Times Square, I will exhale in relief. Mr. Rappaport writes from Queens, New York. And Bruce J. says, all this celebration presumes that Disney lawyers and lobbyists don't lock us out for another 20 or 30 years by getting Congress to extend copyright again. Who controls the past, the future, who controls the present, controls the past. George Orwell, 1984. Dratman says, I am heartened to read Smithsonian's exposition of the U.S. copyright snarl caused by corporate greed and short-sighted political cowardice. Anyone who reads and thinks about this matter is forced to conclude that it is immoral and contrary to the spirit of the Constitution to tie up creative work for so many decades. Those who voted for the legislation in Congress had to have known they were creating bad law. Next, the crazy tricks early filmmakers used to fake snow. Cornflakes, flour, and asbestos were all used in early movies. By Kat Eschner, Smithsonian.com. It's white, it looks fluffy and cold. It's flour and salt. Early filmmakers resorted to some pretty weird substances to create fake winter wonderlands. Some of them were even toxic. During the early days of Hollywood, fake snow was commonly used in place of the real thing, and there weren't any computerized effects that could make snow, writes Ernie Smith for Atlas Obscura. One early substance used was cotton, he writes, until a fireman pointed out that it was a bad idea to cover a film set in a flammable material. But a number of other materials were used over time to make it look as if it was snowy, even on a hot summer's day on set. Take the beloved Christmas classic It's a Wonderful Life, for example. It was shot in June and July of 1946, writes Andrew Lazuski for Gizmodo. The fictional town of Bedford Falls, where the winsome drama was set, was covered in newly quiet fake snow, made out of fomite, the material used in fire extinguishers, mixed with sugar, water, and soap flakes. Some 6,000 gallons of the stuff were used on set, writes Ben Cosgrove for Time, and RKO Effects Department won an award for the new snow. The artificial snow even clung convincingly to clothing and created picture-perfect footprints, he writes. For a period before that, according to Cosgrove, fake movie snow was mostly made from cornflakes painted white. Sometimes they were mixed with shaved gypsum. It was so noisy that any snowy scenes that had dialogue had to be redubbed after. A little disconcerting, though, are reports that asbestos was also used to dress up some of the sets, he writes. The known cancer-causing substance asbestos was used on more than one set. The famous scene in The Wizard of Oz, where Dorothy falls asleep in a field of poppies and wakes up in a snowstorm, used asbestos, writes Smith. And it wasn't the only film set to use asbestos in the 1930s. Over the years, filmmakers have used a number of other substances to create the illusion of snow. Marble dust in Dr. Zhivago, 1965. Salt and flour in Charlie Chaplin's The Gold Rush, 1925, and plain old salt in 1978's Superman. These days, CGI plays a large part, as well as environmentally friendlier products like Snow Cell. So when you settle down with holiday favorites this year, think about where the snow came from. Kat Eschner is a freelance science and culture journalist based in Toronto. Kurt Vonnegut's unpublished World War II scrapbook reveals origins of Slaughterhouse-Five. Volume features 22 letters from author to his family, photographs of the razed city of Dresden, telegrams, and news clippings. By Milan Soli, Smithsonian.com. When he was an American prisoner of war in Nazi Germany, Kurt Vonnegut famously survived the 1945 aerial bombing of Dresden by hiding in the meat locker of a slaughterhouse, a harrowing experience that closely informed the plot of his masterful 1969 novel, Slaughterhouse-Five. During his lifetime, Vonnegut commented extensively on this wartime episode, cataloging the destruction of possibly the world's most beautiful city and describing the burial duties undertaken by him and his fellow POWs. Most significantly, the retrieval of 130,000 corpses trapped underground, a task that the writer in typically blunt fashion later termed a terribly elaborate Easter egg hunt. But until now, Lauren Christensen reports for the New York Times a trove of photographs, newspaper clippings, and correspondence compiled by Vonnegut and his family between 1944 and 1945 had remained unseen by the public, carefully hidden in the safekeeping of the author's sister and his father. The 84-page volume, which sold for $187,500 in Christie's Fine Printed Books and Manuscripts auction earlier this month, includes 22 letters from Vonnegut to his family, photographs the young soldier took of the razed city of Dresden, and a January 1945 telegram stating that Private First Class Kurt Vonnegut Jr. has been reported missing in action. According to Christie's, the notes reflect Vonnegut's trademark satire and dry humor, even under the most dire of circumstances. In a January 3, 1945 letter composed around 2 weeks after his capture, he offers a gross understatement. "It's been one hell of a holiday season for all of us." And in a message written 2 days after his liberation, he declares, "It's a source of great delight to be able to announce that you will shortly receive a splendid relic of World War II with which you may decorate your hearth, namely, me in an excellent state of preservation." Other letters underscore traumas the author couldn't bear to mask with lighthearted jests. As he says in a May 21 note, "This letter started as a huge joke, but there's nothing funny in watching friends starve to death or in carrying body after body out of inadequate air raid shelters to mass kerosene funeral pyres. And that is what I've done the past 6 months." Justin L. Mack of the Indianapolis Star explains that Vonnegut, an Indianapolis native, enlisted in the United States Army in January 1943 when he was enrolled as a chemistry major at Cornell University. Following short stints at the Carnegie Institute of Technology and the University of Tennessee, where he was assigned to study mechanical engineering, he was deployed to Europe with the 106th Infantry Division. Soon after arrival, he was taken prisoner by the Nazis, who were mounting their last great offensive of the war at the Battle of the Bulge, and sent to Dresden alongside fellow POWs. Writing for Mental Floss, Suzanne Raga notes that Vonnegut spent his days working long hours in a malt syrup factory. At night, he slept in the subterranean slaughterhouse that ultimately saved his life. Only one of the letters included in the newly publicized scrapbook had been previously published. Dated May 29, 1945, the retrospective missive written from a repatriation camp in Le Havre, France, describes the sadistic and fanatical guards responsible for watching over the prisoners during their time in Dresden. As the only American with some knowledge of German, Vonnegut became the group's de facto leader, a position he lost after telling the guards just what I was going to do to them when the Russians came. Around Valentine's Day 1945, the Americans launched an unprecedented firebombing campaign against Dresden, killing anywhere from 35,000 to 135,000 people. But not, the author noted, me. In Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse 5, an ill-suited soldier similarly escapes death and eventually describes the aftermath of the scene as a desolate landscape, like the moon. Following his release in mid-1945, Vonnegut returned to Indianapolis. He debuted his first novel, Player Piano, in 1952, but it was his sixth novel, Slaughterhouse 5, that made him a household name. The main conceit of the novel, the protagonist, Billy Pilgrim, has become unstuck in time, leaving him to float through the entirety of his past, makes a somber point. As Jonathan Creasy of the Los Angeles Review of Books lays out, it's that massacres such as Dresden happened. They always have happened, and they always will happen. Vonnegut himself once darkly stated that the Dresden bombings were so meaningless that he may have been the only individual to have gotten something out of them. One way or another, I got $2 or $3 for every person killed, he once said. Some business I'm in. Larger philosophical questions raised by Vonnegut's work aside, the wartime scrapbook offers a glimpse into the burgeoning mind of the author. Many of the characteristics apparent in his later writings are evident in nascent form, but other qualities are wholly singular, affording the volume a unique place in Vonnegut lore. It remains to be seen whether the scrapbook's new owner will publish the letters and assorted ephemera in full, but if not, fans can at least draw on the excerpts provided by Christie's. As the author famously concluded, "And so it goes." Mylan Sully is a Washington, D.C.-based arts and science journalist. She has previously served as Smithsonian's American Society of Magazine Editors intern and a Kiplinger.com editorial intern. And lastly, this is why cats bite you sometimes when you pet them. So does anyone really know why cats do the things they do? Not really, but veterinarians like to at least make educated guesses. And one of the biggest burning questions about cat behavior is this one. How come sometimes your cat turns into a soft and fluffy version of the Incredible Hulk when you're in the middle of what you thought was a bonding moment? According to Vet Street, cats who bite the hand that pets them probably don't do it for no reason, even though it seems like that's just what happened as you were standing there in a wispy cloud of cat hair watching the blood seep from your hand while Kitty retreats to the opposite end of the house. Owners call these love bites, but vets have a much more psychopathic moniker for the behavior, pet-induced aggression. Signs of petting-induced aggression include biting while being petted and staring evilly at sleeping humans from dark corners of the room. These are a few theories about why some cats might do this. Kitty might be getting a small taste so she'll know what spices to add to the pot after she finally gets around to murdering you in your sleep. This one isn't generally accepted by veterinary professionals, though. Really, she may be trying to control the situation. The ancestor of the modern house cat was probably a solitary animal, so the whole social hierarchical thing is pretty new to her. Your cat may reach a point during that moment of shared affection when she thinks, I can't let this person think I'm actually domesticated. I'd better just bite him. And that ending went a little off track. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long, until next time.